In any case, Martin has suggested that what I'm going to talk about really complements a number of things that came up yesterday with respect to issues of public participation, political participation, and I'm going to be talking a little less about that paper, which sort of circles the airport, as my wife likes to say, in terms of, I think, not making a sustained argument. But I'd like to talk about this book that came out a year ago from Oxford called Dealing with Differences. The heart of the book is really in the subtitle, and the subtitle is Dramas of Mediating Public Disputes. And I'm interested, I've been studying mediators, essentially, mediators of public disputes. And I got to mediators because I work in a city and regional planning department in which we love to preach participation and then run like hell, right? Everybody preaches participation and then, you know, looks for a hole to climb into. One of the most wonderful bits from a little bit of field work with city planners was from a staff meeting once, and was the morning after one of the biggest hearings about one of the biggest developments in this region in probably 10 or 15 years. And the director asks Patrick, the associate director who was at the meeting, how'd the meeting go? And Patrick says, it was a terrific meeting, smile. 7 people showed up. Huge project. Terrific, a wry smile. Terrific meeting, 7 people showed up. What's the point? We weren't surprised. We fulfilled the necessity to have the obligation to have a meeting. We can go on with our work. And the smile said, this is ridiculous. You know, this is no semblance of participation. In any case, because of the fraught nature of participation, obviously as a democratic ideal, obviously as ostensibly a practical ideal in forms of public administration and planning, because participation means conflict. Why does he say it's great meeting 7 people showed up? It means they didn't lose control. There wasn't huge conflict that threw them off schedule for a couple of months, right? Because participation means difference, participation means conflict. Conflict means there has to be a way of reconciling, resolving, engaging with conflict in a way that something gets done rather than just having people yell at each other and leave, right? Because there's no way then to talk about participation without talking about conflict. I wanted to study people whose very job it is to design the processes, mechanisms, processes, and do the work over a year, 6 months, over a year, whatever it would be, about complex public disputes in which parties had many years of distrust, anger, and much less affection, right, for each other, and where mediators were actually able to have them craft agreements. So I thought, well, okay, the mediators are ones who are up against this problem of anger, distrust, years of conflict, value differences, obviously, in interest difference, right? And I'll try to learn from these mediators a whole set of things that planners might need to know or might be able to learn. So that's the background to the book. That's the background to the talk. The title about the construction of impossibility comes about because it strikes me that many planners look at situations, look at conflict, and will quit too early. What does quit too early mean? Quit too early means they see it as impossible. No, we're never going to get Daniel in the same room as Martin with Roger because of what Roger did last time, because of what Martin said, because of how Daniel feels. So they will construct a situation as impossible for a variety of reasons that I'll go through it again in a minute. Whereas mediators know to see exactly the same signals, what Roger did, what Daniel thinks, what happened. Mediators see exactly the same cues, exactly the same empirical information, and they say, no, lots of things are possible. So I was trying to explore that construction of a situation. Why do some people see lots of possibilities in other times when they don't? And so this also grows out of concern with what I would call deliberative practices. I wrote 10 years before a book called The Deliberative Practitioner that was a deliberate play on Donald Schoen's book on reflective practice, which is a sort of deeply Deweyan learning by doing kind of account. But in deliberative practice, we have the political problem. How is it that groups will learn through their practice, learn about who we are, what we can do, what we want, and so on. So one of my questions in the time remaining for the group will be, how is it that people learn about their interests? If interests aren't given, how do we make sense of learning about interests, and how does interest change, and how does that change by the institutional conditions of people's meeting and engaging one another? So we'll come back. So deliberation, of course, is suspect. Participation is suspect for reasons we heard this morning. Consensus building takes too much time. All the people leave for various reasons. You're down to the two guys who are the hardcore. They make the decision, which is a parody, of course. So, suspicions of deliberation. Why do people quit too soon? Too much talk. Too much inequality. Too much emotion. Too much bad information. Takes too long. Right. So this involves then, obviously, issues of power and inequality, the micropolitics of how planners and facilitators, managers of such processes, how they work, what's the role of expertise and learning, and finally, how do we go from talk to getting things done? So what I tried to do in the book was exploit a method that I had fallen into, which I will call practice-focused oral histories. Some of you will know about Studs Terkel's work on oral histories. What a colleague at Cornell and I have tried to do is do oral histories that are not life history-focused, but project-focused. So we will ask practitioners, please choose a case that shows the difficulties and the opportunities of your work. Choose a case that shows the blood and the guts. We weren't interested in any simple success stories, but we also weren't interested in just where everything went wrong. We wanted to know, pick a case that shows your work out of the last 20 years, something that really shows what you're up against, where it's tough, but also why you keep getting out of bed in the morning, right? And then we'll walk through that case with them. And when we walk through the case with them, there is one single rule that's helpful. We will never ask them, what do you think about X? We will always ask them, how did you handle X? And you get remarkably different information, and you get a very different narrative response when you do that. If you say, what did you think about pressure from the mayor? They'll say, well, let me tell you about politics in this city, and you'll get their theory of politics. We don't want their theory of politics. We want to know, how did you handle the pressure from the mayor? And if you ask that question, how did you handle it? How did you respond to the pressure from the mayor? You will get a grounded story, and they will explain to you lots about what they think about the pressure from the mayor, but you'll get a much more grounded story. So what we tried to do is get a whole range of accounts, first with planners and then more recently with mediators. How did you handle the surprises in the case, the pressures in the case, all sorts of issues? So if I'm interested in anger and the emotions as part of deliberation, I won't ask them, what do you think about anger? I'll say, how did you handle anger in the case, and how did that go? And I'll get very rich material then to sort of write about. So let me give you some examples of the kind of cases that I'm interested in and that the book talks about. In Colorado, Mike Hughes was asked by the State Health Department to convene a bottom-up process for the spending of federal money on HIV/AIDS education. Bottom-up process in this case for Mike meant we want religious fundamentalists in the room, we want sex workers in the room, we want ACT-UP activists in the room, we want community organizers in the room, we want State Health Department officials in the room, we want city representatives in the room. He starts with 110 people. He runs most of the process with 55 people. with lots of people in the same room who'd never been in the same room together. And after about 9 months, he comes up with a set of recommendations for the state health department on how to spend federal money based on this broad sort of multi-stakeholder representative process, how to target this federal money on HIV/AIDS education. So there's a case, if you ever want, example of deep value differences and deep differences separating parties. Mike has them in the room. And I was curious, how in the world do you do this work? Because as I've said to many of the mediators that I've interviewed, I say, I know lots of colleagues, lots of people in planning profession and more broadly, who would get to the doorway of the room with those with this range of stakeholders, and they'd say, no way. I'm at, you know, it turn around, go the other way. So I'm always trying to find out what is it the mediators are doing, how they're handling such cases. Second, in Hawaii, Peter Adler is asked by the State Planning Office and the Hawaii legislature in the aftermath of something that was called the PASH decision to bring together bankers, realtors, Native Hawaiian cultural practitioners, and planners and others, because the court decision had said that the Native Hawaiians could go on to Clarissa's private, black, into Clarissa's backyard, basically, to pick crops, to pick flowers and herbs for Native Hawaiian traditional practices. And the court found for the Native Hawaiians. And the real estate industry went bonkers and said, how in the world can I sell property to somebody when they may have somebody coming on, you know, with rights to pick from their garden? So Peter gets to, they ask Peter, please convene a process with the bankers, the realtors, the cultural practitioners, tell us what to do. Similarly, structures a process. He very interestingly asked them to come, not for a negotiation, not for a mediation. He says, will you, he picks representatives, will you come for a study group? I said, why do you say study group? He says, if I ask people to come for a mediation or a facilitation or a joint problem solving, they're going to come and kill each other, beat each other up. Maybe if they come for a study group, they'll come and they try to find out, you know, what's going on. Very, very simple framing. You see this a lot. In California, Lisa Butler, she's an ex-motorcycle cop for the state parks agency. She's asked to come in to a group of about 50 of about an off-highway vehicle controversy. Environmentalists want to keep the vehicle riders off of state parks and federal parks and related lands. The recreationists and the hunters and others say, no, that's what they're partly there for. We want to be able to ride. We want to be able to hunt. We want to be able to do these things. They've been in court for about 20 years. They've been beating up on each other for 20 years. State Parks Agency hires a mediator from the, who's worked for the state. He's done a lot of labor stuff. Gets them together. And in the second meeting, they fire him. Fire him. Just gone. And then somebody says, well, maybe we should ask Lisa Butler, the Center for Collaborative Policy in Sacramento. Lisa, having been the motorcycle rider, motorcycle cop, knows motorcycles, having been working for the parks agencies, knows environmental folks, interviews the people, they agree, yes, you know, we will meet with you. And she manages over 9 months, not only to come up with agreements about suggested regulations for vehicle use and design and so on, but other states are looking at it too, and the state of California creates a standing round table after her work, right? Calgary, Larry Sherman, architect, planner. His architecture firm is hired to build new stations because the subway is being extended. He has the contract from the city of Calgary to redesign the bus routes to the ends of the lines now, because the city doesn't trust. Are you kidding? The city doesn't trust the transportation staff to have the people skills to have a multi-stakeholder process to redesign the bus routes. So Larry Sherman does does that, tells that story. So I'm looking at those stories. In a compressed end, let me tell you some of the lessons that grow out of the work of these practitioners in these cases that are complex enough for many people to say no way, and yet they pull it off. So in a way, there's a background problem that I'm interested in, which is studying possibility. If my assumption is we're not always at the frontier, we're not in the best of all possible worlds, there are many other things that we could be doing. I'm trying to understand that, how we can do better. So when I write about we could do this better, we could do this better, we could do this better, I get somebody writing a book review of this saying Forrester's fervently optimistic. It's not a matter of optimism or pessimism. There's a wonderful Paul Goodman quote in Utopian Essays and Practical Proposals. Goodman says it's not about optimism or pessimism. It's about the question, now what? Right? So I'm interested in a sort of critical pragmatism. How is it we can do better? What can we say about doing better? A couple things here that these people do. First of all, they integrate participation in negotiation. Right? Usually these things are talked about in very different ways and with great suspicion, too much talk, 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 or negotiation is compromise. They do something very different. If you look at participation on one axis and negotiation on another, and you say, where's there not much, nothing's getting negotiated, but lots of people in the room, you got public hearings. Public hearings are political design from hell, right? Public hearings bring 100 people in so they can get 3 minutes each, they can yell at each other, and they can leave more upset, more angry, less trusting, and more cynical about government than when they started the meeting. And this is our main default position about public participation, which is a disgrace. It's a disgrace in planning, in public administration. It's a disgrace for political science and political theory and political philosophy to allow this to exist as anything remotely called public participation. But it's our default. If you go here, not many people participating, but a lot getting negotiated, you have backroom deal making, right? Italian style, old style, fine, not much participation. Not much participation, not much negotiation, you have administration as usual. The people who work in public administration, they're not supposed to be negotiating, they're not supposed to be running participatory process typically. So that leaves a quadrant here, high participation, even if it's multi-stakeholder representatives, high participation, and things getting negotiated so everybody's not just covering their butts and lying to each other and having sort of lose-lose outcomes. So this quadrant is the quadrant in which the mediators that I've been studying work. Many representatives, many stakeholders, and they're actually crafting and inventing options that satisfy their interests because there's been a process of assessing, convening, learning with expertise, and only at the very end, negotiating and crafting outcomes. And so there's a whole process design question that comes up here about deliberation, which is not sort of what's deliberation supposed to look like, quote, at the table, but what is a process of involvement, of learning, of people meeting each other, listening to each other's stories, and so on, that makes that possible. So I will end with I don't even want to say a triple helix. Yes, a strand, a rope of three strands that I think in the applied literature we don't pay any attention to, and it has lots of ways it could be developed. The work here that integrates high levels of representative participation and negotiation is composed of these three strands of dialogue, debate, and negotiation. And if I would label I would say this is public deliberation. But the practice then, I'm suggesting the practice of public deliberation involves all three of these. And notice, of course, if you only have the first two, dialogue or debate, you're open to all of the traditional charges of it goes on forever, it takes much too much time, and it's just talk, talk, talk. There's no connection to action, right? If you only have dialogue, you have face-to-face understanding, you may have lousy information, you have no scientific quality, you may have nothing get done. If you have just debate,
You have the war of scientists, and it may be solving the wrong problem because they haven't formulated the problem correctly, and nothing will get done. If you have just negotiation, you may also be solving the wrong problem. So these three things are practically quite different. If I'm talking to planning students, I say notice that what helps dialogue is maybe facilitation. What helps a debate is some work we call moderating. What helps a negotiation is mediating. And those are as different as, I don't know, you know, a car and a Ferrari and a 747. Facilitating is different than moderating is different than mediating. They're really three different things. And in the faculty meetings that most of us hate, these all get smooshed together. Some people are there to get something done, some people are there to prove that they're right, and other people are there just to try to figure out what the hell's going on. And as long as those three moments, those three processes, and those three practices of facilitating, moderating, and meeting, as long as that's mixed up, we're going to have the bedlam that we see all the time. But, so, two sentences more, and I'll stop. The two one-liners I'll leave you with. One, mediators don't make agreements any more than midwives make babies. I said this in Sheffield, and I said, who makes the babies? And the students were blushing. Can I try it in Canada? Who makes the babies? Oh, come on, you're as quiet as the students in Sheffield. Who makes the babies?
God.
Good. Well, that's good. At least somebody, one of the kids in Sheffield said the moms. And I said, all by themselves. Okay, parents, is that? Oh, that's amazing. You know, the philosophers are quieter than the students in Sheffield. And now he's blushing instead of the, okay.
It's a real philosophical puzzle.
It is. It's true. It's true. It's a better question than I knew. The other, okay. But. It depends, right, exactly. Mediators, it's important in my context because people say, oh, the planners are going to make the decisions. No. Mediators don't make the agreements any more than the midwives make babies. The parties make the agreements. Second one-liner. I presented this in Sacramento at the Center for Collaborative Policy. They said, yeah, what about deep value differences? And the, one of those rare times when you sort of feel like you're channeling some other voice, and the sentence came out, I said, look, we can have deep disagreements about what our God requires of us, and we might still agree where the stop sign should go. Right? That strikes me as sort of the wisdom of American pragmatism as a philosophical tradition. You correct me if I'm wrong. But we can disagree about lots of doctrine, and we can still agree on all sorts of practical specifics. And mediators know that, and I think most planners and lots of other political actors don't. So we hear deep value differences, and we think in order to act, we have to settle doctrine. That's nonsense. We can hear deep value differences, and we need to know to look for a level of practical specifics that will allow us to live together without killing each other, without resolving the doctrinal differences. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
So I really appreciate the fact of demushing, to use a technical word, the dialogue, the debate, the negotiation. And, you know, as philosophers, we may have a built-in sort of tendency to confuse, especially debate, and the idea that you can get to an agreement without having to figure out everything that separates you, I think is a very salutary thing. So the question is, the one thing I didn't hear so much in your talk is, how do you engineer situations so that the outcome that you get is actually, in some very rough sense of what this term means, fair. In other words, that you haven't had people being bullied to a solution, either explicitly bullied or, what is more difficult to root out, sort of bullied by, you know, not by somebody speaking loud or somebody making threats, but kind of by people's perceptions of the asymmetry that's built into the situation. Look, this is probably the best we can get if we leave the room without getting to an agreement. Sure, it's a crappy agreement, but, you know, it's and people, the other people on the other side know that. So there's all sorts of implicit, unspoken things that go on in the way of unfairness that doesn't involve somebody with a big stick actually threatening sure. to wield it. Sure. So do we have to water down our expectations of fairness, or are there ways in which
I don't think so. I mean, I think the question, if you tease apart the kind of concerns that are in the question, you could see a number of practical things that could be done almost step by step. So that mediators will talk, of course, about kinds of ground rules in meetings themselves, and they'll often find that the parties themselves will agree to a set of things, like we'll try no personal attacks, and we'll try to give each other time and stuff. Very simple, but then they'll go after that to try to see that there's. They'll try to level information. They'll try to make sure that everybody has expertise available. They'll try to see, you know, how people can get whether technical assistance or have access to information. So there's, I think, a whole rich catalog of things that can be done, down to ways that groups meet as a whole or separately, the way. So that the kind of intimidation, there are gender things and personality things, all of that can, I think, can be responded to. People
yeah. So, I mean, all those things, I can see how, you know, they involve sort of making sure that what goes on within the process.
And who's at the table in the first place,
right.
of course.
Okay. Right.
Right. Who's, how do we understand who's affected? Who needs to be there? Who can speak for whom? The choice of representative. I mean, there are no solutions. Wait a minute. I may be optimistic that we can do better than we're doing. That doesn't. There's no panacea here. There's no technical fix,
right?
Right? There's no cookbook answer. These are important. I'm the last one to say that fairness isn't an important question. It needs to be addressed in.
Right. So let me ask, I'm going to go at it one last time, and then
sure.
I'll pass
sure,
the mic.
Sure, sure.
Can you imagine any circumstances in which a responsible, a morally responsible mediator would say, you know, I can see how a deal could come out of this, but I would rather not sign off on it. In other words, I would rather that we end up in a deadlock, though I can see a situation that would come out of this where the people who are sort of less powerful would do slightly better than if we arrive at a deadlock. It still seems to me to be, so there are situations in which you think that that's the morally responsible thing to do, to not sign off on an agreement, even if it does represent a slight.
I think you can identify forms of coercion or where somebody is yes.
Okay. As I'm listening to this, I mean, I think it's, again, it has this sort of intuitive yes, of course. And I'm sort of struck because I'm involved in a subcommittee of concerned parents and residents from my kid's school in a city, you know, 4 or 5 hours from here, Hamilton. And the board, the school board, has a proposal that, and so we have sort of three schools in two distinct sort of walkable communities, but that are separated by a main kind of artery that's sort of really, really doesn't isolate the communities, but it makes it clear that these are two community schools that are walkable, and it's looking like, and everyone was pretty sure, they just want to shut one down. I work with a geographer and a planner who's, you know, and we were sifting through the census data to build up a case before we'd even heard the proposal, and all the parents were raring to go. And I was struck by how many of the planners and the people who set up the public meetings must know your work, because this is exactly what they did. And then what shocked me was everyone was pissed at the first meeting, because they didn't want to assess and convene and learn, right? They wanted to hear the board proposal right up front, so we knew, you know, they knew what they were fighting, and they could get right down to the, you know, debate and decide. And they weren't being angry and uninformed about it. I was struck, this is one of these kind of fairly affluent, privileged neighborhoods, frankly, where probably, you know, the board is right to worry, and they should go beat up on, you know, sort of less affluent neighborhoods, which is something that most of the parents in this neighborhood conveniently ignore. But there's all of those kind of dynamics in the background of educated parents who are worried about the way the board has acted in other districts, but yet still has a bit of NIMBYism. They still want their walkable schools in their neighborhood. very sophisticated thinking, and the last thing they want to do is this. And so how do you deal with that when you're sort of faced with fairly sophisticated strategists in the audience who kind of know what you're doing, and they just want to kind of skip all this deliberative stuff and get straight to the, you know, let's argue it out because we've got to put two schools somewhere, and here's where we want them, and we know that they're going to fight it. And I mean, at the end of the day, are there just some settings where it's just going to, you know, quickly move to conflict?
I think it's very common. I mean, the mediators talk about often being called into a situation way late because the government's been very optimistic. Oh, we can deal with this ourselves. And they see mediation as giving up some measure of control, which I don't think is right. As you're asking the question, I have this sort of echo of Peter Adler, the guy who did this case in Hawaii, and he has this wonderful passages where he's talked about people doing drive-by solution seeking. Everybody's confident. I know the answer. I know what we want. Let's get it done because we don't have time. And the deeper what's interesting there at a deeper level is what I would summarize as: if curiosity kills cats, it's presumption that kills negotiators. Right? And so it's the overconfidence and presumption. I know everything I need to know, so I know what the solution is. And everybody walks in with that, and the mediator's job is to slow people down. Not because the mediators want to take time, but because people will make stupider decisions because they're blinded by their own overconfidence. So yeah, you'll have people say, let's make a deal, let's cut to the chase, but there's nothing that suggests that that's going to help the process or help the way they feel about it either. So part of the task there, I think, is maybe having them listen a little bit to one another and seeing, well, wait a minute, maybe there's more to work with than we thought. Maybe there are other options than we thought. And so that reframing is really crucial. You know, the strength of the presumption is one of the problems here. It doesn't help people when they're at odds, I think. Because usually it's not just an A or B, it's not just yes or no decision. Now in your case it might be, but the odds are it isn't.
It ended up being the board proposal is exactly what the parents feared. But I kind of agree, right? We have another proposal we want to put forward. Yeah. That does try to sort of make some concessions. But now that the board proposal's out, everyone's like, oh, okay, so no one shows up at meetings. No one wants to see all this data we put together, and it was just sort of like, oh, I guess we're done.
Abner?
Israeli politics are off the table.
Don't worry. I'm away from it now. Two questions. One, empirical studies of deliberative processes show that you're unlikely to reach innovative decisions because this mechanism of, you know, learning from each other and so on creates an atmosphere in which people want to reach agreement and compromise, and therefore you're very unlikely to reach, you know, innovative decisions. So you'll have some kind of, the decisions will be conservative in the sense that there won't be any big change. On the other hand, of course, the decisions will be more legitimate because they'll have this support from the process. So I would like to know what's your opinion about the balance between the two. And the other question continues Daniel's second.
Let me just say on the first, I think we would want to look at what the sample is. I mean, what kinds of deliberations we're talking about. My sense is in these cases there are enough surprising sort of reframing of problems, so they don't lead me to worry about.
Well, I'll give you an example
that you're talking about.
Can I give you an example?
Yeah, sure.
I did some empirical research, so I took a lot of students and I told them that the university was going to decide whether to have an organic cafeteria. Okay, and their first reaction was fantastic. Yeah, let's have it, right? Organic, it's good for you. And then some people started to say, but it's going to be expensive, and I introduced all kinds of information into it. into the debate at different stages. And the longer the discussion was and the more information they received, the less happy they were about changing things. Oh, let's stick to what we have, you know, don't bother about new cafeterias and so on and so forth. And this reflects, this goes hand in hand with information that we have from different research that was done in different cases about these processes. So especially when you have ideological issues.
But it sounds like there that the decision's fairly constrained and that the study is drawing a conclusion about information overload or ways to punish search or something like that.
Well, part of the problem is information load. I mean, the more information people get, the more they become conservative. They say, oh, I can't deal with this, you know, this is too much. Let's go to what I know, to what is familiar to me. Do you see what I mean?
Well, I'd like to see it.
Okay.
I'd like to see some of the work.
I can send you this, okay.
It's not intuitively obvious to me that this is gonna work. Right. You had a second thing with the Echo Dan you were saying.
Right, yeah. So one of the values of this process is that hopefully you can reach a better decision and one that will have that will be considered legitimate. But the other value is that is the side effect that you create a community or that you strengthen the community. What is usually I mean, sometimes, again, empirical research of these processes show that sometimes the participants forget about the decision. What they want is their community. And for example, people who were interviewed several months after these processes reported that they became very, you know, friends with the participants and so on. What is the position of the mediators? I mean, are they sensitive to this issue of the community forming or are they focused?
Most mediators who talk about this kind of thing will say that the relationships get better. Relationships get better. It doesn't mean that they agree, but people will tend to respect each other more. They will understand each other better. There's an amazing case in Boston after the shootings in the abortion clinics years ago, for 5 years, there was sort of a group of leaders on both sides of these issues who then wrote a piece after 5 years of discussion saying, we have been meeting in secret for 5 years as leadership from these other organizations, and we are only more devoted and committed to our positions than we were before, but we now have a much deeper respect and even affection and concern for the other side. And we have become better leaders of our movements, and we think both on both sides less inflammatory, less prone to especially some of the conservative religious folks were much more actively disavowing some outsiders who had supported sort of violence in some cases, and so it's very interesting. The general answer is that these people will always talk about the importance of relationship building, of respect and recognition, which is not just it's an outcome consideration as well as a process consideration. But one of the things I didn't mention here is these processes, you can't talk about, I think, outcome and process. I mean, process and outcome are always linked in negotiation. This is not unlike in dialogue. I mean, you can have lots of dialogue and you don't have necessarily the production of some result different than the process itself.
Okay, so in a sense, my question is following up on several of these. Daniel's concern about equality, Lauren's about disengagement, which is that you're telling, like, your argument is about how deliberation and mediation are fostering lots of really good things like tolerance and respect and better outcomes. But I'm concerned from my understanding of your method, because you said that in the beginning that you asked people to tell you about their experiences that showcased the challenges and the strengths of the method. So you're not asking them, you're kind of directing them to give you cases in which deliberation produces good outcomes. And I'm wondering if you're missing really important information about when deliberation produced unfairness, disengagement, conservatism. And I just wonder if there's a problem in the design or the method.
I think it's a terrific question. I am looking for both the difficulties and the opportunities, right? So in Peter Adler's case in Hawaii, for example, they came up with, the legislature said, what do we do after this court decision? They said, do nothing. So sometimes people think that there's a bias in these processes to come up with something. You're going to do something. You're going to build something. So he's sort of a counter case there. I'm not trying to generalize across all mediation cases. I'm not trying to say anybody who says they're a mediator, they're going to do good things for you. I'm trying to look at really difficult cases where people in a way did some surprising work. And I'm not saying everybody can do it, and I'm not saying it's something for all cases, but I am trying to explore
like possible.
Yeah, and I don't, but I, yes, but I don't use that language.
Right.
I'm trying to see what are the various moves so that when Peter Adler says, will you come for a study group? And he knows that I won't, they won't, if, or Larry Sherman in another interview says, mayor of a small town outside Toronto, they had an incinerator proposal. And the mayor said, everybody come on down, we're going to have a public debate about the incinerator. And then they hire Larry to run the meeting. And they're having extra police show up because they're so afraid of what's going to happen at the meeting. So the first thing Larry Sherman does is says, wait a minute, we're not going to have a debate. We're going to try to learn about what this decision is about. It affects all of you. You all care deeply about this community. We're going to try to learn what in the world's going on. And there, it's just, I mean, there are some, you know, there are lots of little things that can actually make a difference in positive ways. Maybe nobody's going to get hurt tonight. And in that, whether Peter's case about a study group or Larry about a debate, there's a framing that sets a different expectation about what are we going to do here tonight, how are we going to treat each other, what are the norms going to be, what are we going to do? Now, that's a small claim. I mean, so I'm claiming that's not insignificant. I'm claiming it's not trivial. I'm claiming it's not terribly significant, but it's not trivial. It's doable. It's much more widely appropriate. A bunch of things that we can learn from these practices. And you're right, there are fiascos that they're alluding to along the way, but that's not my focus. And there's lots of fiascos, sure.
Yeah, I've been thinking of this really interesting scheme for negotiation with respect to cities in particular. And I'm wondering, two things, I guess. I mean, it has to do with how universal they are. First, are they universal? Are the principles, or might there be different principles, or different versions of the principles, or different emphases of the principles when you're talking about negotiations in cities? And secondly, are there things about cities that make negotiation that are especially advantageous or especially disadvantageous to successful negotiation?
Well, sure. I mean, let me take the last, let me work it backwards. It seemed to me there's all sorts of issues of scale that are begged here, right? And I don't pretend to know the answer to issues of scale, but it's clear to me that if we can learn from cases like Mike Hughes and the HIV case I gave you, it seems that there are many, we could learn about elements of such processes and then we can think about what that means at larger scale. So, one thing is doing it for, San Francisco, another thing is doing it for the metropolitan region of New York or something, but conceivably, but so things like that. But it seems to me, what kind of things are shared? Seems to me what's shared is
complexity, plurality, interconnectedness, therefore the necessity for engagement, participation, negotiation of some form. And what, I don't know if universal is the right language, but I think we know that if people are negotiating with any kind of difficult or realistic histories, that everybody has the incentive to hide information, to misrepresent, to exaggerate. And then if we make decisions based on mutual deception, we shouldn't be surprised that the decisions suck, technical language, right? I mean, and therefore unassisted, so that's just making a case for unassisted negotiation as opposed to assisted negotiation. Unassisted negotiation, I'm going to hide information, you're going to hide information, we're both going to exaggerate, and there's no reason to think that unassisted, when we don't trust each other and we've got bad history, that we're going to do well. So that's a case, that's a fairly general case, I think, to try to get some assistance so that we don't hold ourselves hostage to our own vulnerability, our own fear of being taken, stuff like that. That's a very simple case. Some of the MIT students a few years ago of Larry Susskind created an Asian dispute resolution network. I mean, it boggles your mind. Representatives from China, Malaysia, Japan, Korea, they're talking about Asian dispute resolution network. So we talk about, are there any kind of generalities, any general principles? And I said, well, the smartest thing that I've ever heard about this kind of work came from an the city engineer of Tel Aviv, actually, who said he'd studied urban design at Columbia University with a Japanese urban designer who talked about building a huge multimodal transportation center in downtown Tokyo. And he asked the Japanese guy, he said, how in the world did you build this in such a congested place with so much fighting, you know, as you have it in Tokyo? And the answer was over 2,000 cups of tea. And when I said that, everybody went, oh yeah, right? So if there's one soft universal here, it's that the relationship building that allows you to learn, to both build relationships and to learn prior, way prior to decision making, is hugely important. So that's to say, ignorance is pretty universal. Presumption is pretty universal. The danger of solving the wrong problem, pretty universal. Thus the the prevalence of distrust, anger, and suspicion, huge. All of those, pretty general. In cities. Okay, so the wisdom of the 2,000 cups of tea is about indirection, is about relationship building, is about limits of rationality, complexity. All right.
Thank you, John. Okay.